Off the Ball. GAA.
I think that I wouldn't be writing anything in stone yet. You know, I wouldn't be proclaiming that we have a 2010 here. I wouldn't be proclaiming we're on the brink of a 5 in a row either. But I think it's a very enjoyable era of Gaelic football that we're in as teams try and figure themselves out.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The news round on Off the Ball. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome along to Thursday night's Off the Ball. Richie Hogan, as always, is with us in studio tonight. He'll be joining us from 8 p.m. to talk hurling. You can get your questions in ahead of him coming into us on WhatsApp. We're on 087-9180-180. We have packed out the studio here for tonight's news round. We've got David Seagrave, who's going to be giving you today's news very shortly. David, how are you doing?
Too bad, how are you?
We've got a football show with Dion Fanning coming up from 9. He's in early. Evening, Dion.
Hi, Owen.
And Jerry Thornley, who's going to be talking rugby from 7:30 with us, has also come in early. Jerry, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
So just to pull the curtain back here a little bit, 100% of the conversations I have with Jerry Thornley on the radio are about rugby union. 100% of the conversations I have with Jerry Thornley off air are about Arsenal Football Club.
This is exactly true. Statistically, you are correct.
How do you feel after last night?
I was furious at the end of it, really livid.
You're still furious?
Not as livid. I've calmed down a little bit. That's what a night's sleep might do and whatever, and just life moving on. I mean, we've had a little chat about it off air and we disagree. I think for VAR to become involved in a penalty the referee gives and for a clear and obvious error, and the referee then has to review it 13 times, which on a screen that is strategically placed within striking range of Diego Simeone and the Atletico Madrid management and players staff and fans, is just a joke. And I mean, he's up there with Mourinho for shithousery, or maybe down there would be more apt use of the word. And I don't like the man, I don't like Atletico, I don't like what they get up to. And
this
is
what Arsenal need.
Disgusted me. But I thought overall it was a pretty good performance and a pretty decent result. And hey, we've got a chance, Arsenal, of making a Champions League final for what, only the third time in history.
How have we never unleashed this before, Jerry? This is amazing. You disagree on that point on the VAR screen? And
I can see why it was overturned.
Okay.
And why?
Because I can't.
Well, I can see why you could say it isn't a penalty, and I accept his point about, you know, the clear and obvious error. But these are the inherent contradictions, unfortunately, in VAR. That
it was a clear and obvious contact too.
If you can make an argument for it. The point is, I honestly feel I can see why it was done. I also think it's one of these things where you can endlessly argue about these events, and it gets very, very, you go down a rabbit hole in terms of arguing about penalties and reversal of penalties. I don't think there should be VAR. I think that's my view on it generally, and I think I would like it to be abolished, and I think you would just get back to a game that where the referee can either award a penalty or not award a penalty and make mistakes. And I think it's a very important point in sport, accepting that referees make decisions. And one of the unintended consequences of VAR is that everything a referee does is now second guessed. And then I accept that he's standing there at the, you know, the VAR referring to the, you know, as Simeone has no power over what the VAR does, wherever the VAR is. But, you know, when you're standing there and he's nearby, you might be thinking, I don't know, but also think, Jerry, that Arsenal probably need, I you deliver that outrage, but more, I feel there's just a genuine integrity to it in a way that I don't think Mikel Arteta can do. I think you should be there, you know, standing up to Simeone next week, and that would give Arsenal a real fight.
Oh, next week, you ain't seen nothing yet. The shithouses would be off the scale. They'd be rolling around within 5 minutes. They'd be waving imaginary cards at the referee from the 10th minute onwards. Simeone would be expending more energy up and down the touchline than Arteta and his team combined. It's going to be incessant. And unless Alvarez can sneak a goal, they'll play for a nil-all draw over 120 minutes and go through in penalties.
Definitely. I think next week could be levels above what we saw last night from both sides. Tell us this. How did you end up becoming an Arsenal fan?
The Irish boys back in the day would be the main reason. That would be the main reason. And then it was strengthened very much because I would have a lot of time for Leeds as well. They'd be my second favourite team, and I watch all of Leeds' games, and I root for them when they're going for promotion or fighting relegation. Arsenal and Leeds tend to operate in different spheres, so it's quite comfortable supporting them as well.
Yeah.
But certainly when Wenger came along, he changed my whole view of football, the way I thought about football, and I truly have loved Arsenal for the last 25 years.
Did you get a chance to cover them much?
No.
It was mostly domestic football that you were
on. When I covered football, it was mostly the Republic of Ireland team, USA 94, and the League of Ireland, which, you know, I'd still miss. I love covering the League of Ireland, but very seldom was I remember doing a Man United-Liverpool FA Cup final once, a few other things like that. But no, I never actually covered an Arsenal game.
I was at Highbury the day Patrick Vieira came on for the first time to make his debut, before Wenger had arrived.
Yes.
And they signed him, and nobody knew who he was.
Yeah.
And Wenger hadn't got there. And this player came on, and everyone was like, oh my God. And it wasn't just like this player. It was like, this manager who we don't really know much about has signed this player. So what's coming down the line? Mm. It was an amazing moment. It was just this extraordinary kind of energy in the stadium in Highbury that day, because you just knew what was coming. And like, that was the great thing about like Wenger, you know, being in England at that time, and it's amazing you say that about how it changed how you viewed football, but I think so many people had that experience, whether they were Arsenal fans or not, with Wenger.
Yeah.
And what he did and how he just brought a different energy to everything. Like, he was an extraordinary person to be at, to listen to at press conferences.
I can imagine, you know, he was. Yeah, he's a very impressive individual, and who knows how many titles Man United would have won in a row without Arsenal on the scene. Like, it made it very compelling, and the rivalry between the two was extraordinary. And Arsenal were a joy to watch. And then there was a slide towards the end of the Wenger years, which was, you and I both know, wasn't very pleasant to watch, and redeemed by the odd FA Cup win, and then when Arteta came in as well. But I think what Arteta's done in the last 4 years at the club has been astonishing. When you think, like, they're only the ninth highest wage bill, only the fifth highest wage bill in England, only the ninth highest in Europe, and here they are, top of the league, and potentially getting to a Champions League final.
And are you unwavering on him, even if it...
I am unwavering on him. It saddens me that, for me, Arsenal are meant to be a joyous brand of football, very expressive, and it hasn't been that for the last few months. I almost have to pinch myself to remind myself that beat Atletico by 4-0 back in whenever it was, and beat Bayern 3-1, brilliant performance back whenever it was. I'm a big advocate of Eze. I've been a fan of Eze since he was in his QPR days. I used to tape the 15-minute highlights in Sky Sports of QPR matches just to watch Eze. Followed his career. I've never been more happier about a signing in Arsenal's history, on the way that it was made and the way it happened, gazumping Spurs and all that. And I just love watching him play. I think he's the Roger Federer of football. He just makes it look so ridiculously easy. He'd be my favourite player, and I think Arsenal are a better watch when he's on the pitch. And I still be hopeful that they can win a trophy this season, in which case it will have been a brilliant season, whichever trophy comes. I prefer the Premier League, obviously, because there's so many. We operate as an extension of the Premier League in this country, and we listen to all these Liverpool and Man United fans. It'd be nice just to be champions just for 1 year.
It's interesting you say that about what you think Arsenal's football should be because of Wenger, when, you know, George Graham wasn't
completely
like that. Bertie Mee wasn't like
No. Wenger reinvented them.
And now you feel that's the football that Arsenal should be playing.
Yeah, I do.
No, I understand that, but it is interesting.
I think the vast bulk of modern Arsenal fans would be like that as well, wouldn't you?
You know, I would think that, but I think if you were talking about what the Arsenal tradition is...
No, I would agree. You reinvented it.
Yeah. You could say, but you could go back and look at, like, the George Graham side. And there was, I think, in Fever Pitch, Nick Hornby has a whole passage on, you know, Spurs always being the more entertaining team.
Yes, they were.
But Arsenal were actually had a bigger support always, in London and outside, but even in London. So it's not, there were different things driving it. But now that legacy of Wenger means that's what people look back to and want again. And I don't know, you don't get it at the moment, though, do you?
No.
You'd wonder, does that give Arteta, you know, does he earn shorter shrift with the fan base because of that? And because of the way in which this season might end, if it does fizzle out, and the style of play that has been present for so much of the second half of the season. Now, they maybe turned a corner in the last couple of games, like the Manchester City and Atletico away performances were the best of 2026, or up there in terms of 2026 performances. But you'd wonder if there's a lack of patience in the project, let's say, if this is the style of play that Arteta is putting forward.
But I think he's become a little bit of a victim of his own success in that when you finish second, is it three times in a row or four? I've lost count.
Three, yeah.
Three, about to be four, maybe. Yeah. Three in a row. I think that engenders an anxiety within the whole club and organisation, and particularly the fan base. I'm only watching it off the TV and hearing it off the TV, but the Emirates seems to be like a torture chamber at the moment for home games. There just seems to be very little joy in watching Arsenal, and it's been like that for a little while now. The Newcastle game looked like a very hard watch, and they've been a hard watch, and I think it's partly the legacy of finishing runners-up three times and also what's looming in their rearview mirror yet again.
Yeah, it's what's that chamber? Is it the anechoic chamber, which is supposed to be like the quietest room in the world, where they say that if you go in there for 1 minute, you will have achieved something that no other man can possibly do, because the sound of your heartbeat will become audible, and it'll just be this self-sense of agony, and you'll have to leave the room straight away. It's kind of what comes to mind when you describe the Emirates as a torture chamber there, that you just can't really appreciate it until you're in there.
I think Champions League nights are better. I think it'll be better next Tuesday.
Yeah, I agree. Carol Leary on YouTube says, "In Jerry we trust. Come on, you Gunners." Patrick says, "Arsenal got a decent result considering how the second half went, but the ref completely bottled the penalty decision." And Owen asks, "Is walking on the club crest outrage a new low for football? Seeing players skirt around it and getting praised on social media for doing so is peak insanity." I'll promise you this, Owen, we will be discussing this on the football show after 9 o'clock. Perhaps Dion Fanning is a sympathiser for Ben White, who is a disgrace to modern football for walking all over the Atletico Madrid crest. Our number is 087-918-180 if you've got any opinions, any questions. David, we are starting with the biggest story in sport today, which involves LIV Golf.
Yes, the Saudi Public Investment Fund has confirmed that it's withdrawing funding from LIV Golf. The rival tour was launched 4 years ago, but has made huge losses, with reports estimating up to $1 billion underwritten by the fund. In a statement released today, PIF confirmed it would only continue its funding until the end of this season. It said the substantial investment required by LIV Golf over a longer term is no longer consistent with the current phase of PIF's investment strategy. A new board has now been assembled for LIV after the fund's governor Yasir Al-Rumayyan resigned. Gene David and John Zinman have since been named as replacements. The tour says it's focused on securing long-term financial partners, and speaking to Golf Weekly on Off the Ball, Paul McGinley says he's not shocked to see the turmoil, but admits the tour has had an impact on the game.
It was never going to pay its way, so that's why I'm not really surprised. What has surprised me is how long it's lasted. But then on the other side, the players win. Players win here, you know. Players on LIV have won. Obviously, they got paid huge amounts of money. The players who have remained on the tours have earned a huge amount of extra money. But it's left the game, in my view, in a very difficult and potentially unsustainable place. The overheads and prize funds now are so huge because of LIV that the tours are under pressure. Everybody else loses except the players. The tours lose, they've got massive overheads. The public lose, you know, because they're seeing a diluted product on TV. They're having to pay a lot more money to go to events now. The sponsors lose because they're having to spend a lot more money to sponsor the same events.
So this is obviously huge news. A lot has changed in the last 2.5 months. Just reading Scott O'Neill, the CEO of LIV, speaking to the Financial Times in February, he said there's a commitment to the long term of this business. That's beyond a shadow of a doubt when he was speaking about the PIF and their investment in the organisation. So they had received $5 billion of funding, principally obviously from the PIF. And in that same interview with the Financial Times, Scott O'Neill gave an outline of when they might expect profitability. And he described the time frame for that as less than 10 and greater than 5 years. Meanwhile, their UK entity alone had reported more than $1 billion of cumulative losses between 2022 and 2024. So you take all this together and you'd have to say now that LIV is in a real spot of bother existentially. What's interesting here as well is that this story is basically the same story as the one we got 2 weeks ago. A number of different places, Financial Times were reporting it, The Athletic were reporting it. It was in a number of different places as well. Like, for example, if I read from The Athletic in April the 15th, this piece was, industry sources have told The Athletic that the public investment fund, the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund that financed the Upstart League, is preparing to pull its multi-billion dollar investment in LIV Golf. So a day later than that, LIV Golf and their tournament in Mexico began. And I want to play this with a couple of journalists in the room here, because at the beginning of their broadcast, Arlo White and David Faherty were fronting the LIV coverage. And here's how their Mexico broadcast began.
David, first of all, delighted to report that reports of the imminent demise of the LIV Golf League were, in fact, greatly exaggerated. I've had a good chat with LIV CEO Scott O'Neill in the last hour. He was very confident about the future, very bullish about the future of the LIV Golf League, and we'll bring you that interview very soon during the show. David, what have you made of another week of noise this week?
Wow, it has been amazing, Arlo, for sure. I've been in the professional game for 50 years now, and I don't think I've ever had two or three days where there was more absolute nonsense, you know, spread out. And you know, there are still some writers and broadcasters that take pride in their work, but this generation has spawned, you know, a bunch of fast typists, you know, that consider themselves to be experts, and evidently they're not.
Yeah, it must be exhausting trying to will the LIV Golf League out of existence. Take a day off, everybody. Enjoy the golf.
So it turns out these fast typists that have been spawned turned out to be correct on this. I mean, it's quite interesting to hear that level of loathing coming from two men who've worked for a long time in the golf media.
Yeah, but are now working for LIV Golf. So they, you know, there was sort of in Arlo White there. I felt, you know, you could hear echoes of sort of Richard Keys in that sense of in the tone of his delivery, in that sort of, you know, like, we know better than you people, and we are here in our environment that we've received certain guarantees about and how it's going to continue, and we know that's not the case, and there was a sort of a slight kind of smugness there. And a superciliousness that, you know, isn't really justified. And I think it's an interesting thing. Like, obviously there's this huge broader conversation about like Saudi investment in sport as well. But like the idea of like the money they put into golf, and I think what Paul McGinley said there is kind of interesting. Like there isn't a market. There isn't a way of making that money back. Like, how were they going to make that money? Like, they weren't going to make that money. Like, the point about it was, whatever financial projections they were, you know, throwing out, it was based on you know, the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia pumping money into it, because there isn't the television money for golf at that level. And as McGinley pointed out, prize money, everything has inflated because of this money, and now. They're going to be looking at a situation where they're going to be thinking, where is the money going to come from in general, not just for LIV, but just the inflationary pressure that has come about because of it. And like all sport, with the exception of football, even a sport like golf in America, it has this struggle where it's like, how are we going to pay our way? How are people going to, you know, are people going to keep paying subscriptions? All the things that they've built their model on. And I think that's the problem for not just LIV, but for golf in general.
Yeah, there's actually a bullishness about the LIV public discourse today in terms of the statements they've put out. There's been a changeover in terms of the management, with the Saudi power brokers no longer involved, and even the stuff that they're saying involves, you know, growing the game, and that this is certainly the best product globally. And if your focus is just on the United States of America, then that's fine, but it's all about the world and trying to expand the reach of golf everywhere. That there is still a lack of self-awareness, I feel, about even some of the current LIV Golf statements. But I guess they're in pure survival mode at this point, so you can possibly understand that. We shall move on here, David. If did you have your two cents on?
Not really. Yeah. I've never watched a minute's LIV Golf, and I never will. You know, it's something I can live without.
We have some new news from Gianni Infantino, from one good guy to another good guy.
Yes. Some breaking news in the last few minutes. FIFA president Gianni Infantino has said that Iran will play at this year's World Cup. He was speaking at the FIFA Congress in Vancouver, and he's also said that they will be playing their games in the United States as originally planned.
Yeah, this is no surprise, really. I didn't really expect that to change in the last couple of weeks. Obviously, there was an outlandish suggestion that there might be some Italian involvement in this year's competition, but that seems to have been swiped pretty quickly by FIFA. We do have some live football tonight.
Yes, two Premier League sides square off in the first leg of the Europa League semi-finals this evening. Nottingham Forest welcome Aston Villa to the City Ground from 8. The visitors are unbeaten against tonight's opponents in their two previous encounters this season. And it's been 40 years since either team lifted a European title. Villa last lifted the European Cup in 1982, while just before that, Forest went back-to-back, winning the titles in 79 and 80. Now, the two teams are just a possible 270 minutes away from ending that drought. Villa have also lost their last two semis under Unai Emery, and he says they're not worried about that record.
But the most important experiences are the experiences we have here together. And our experiences are semi-final in Conference League, quarter-final in Champions League, again, semi-final in Europa League. Of course, the semi-final in FA Cup last year is a little different, but as well, another experience we have. And we must try to learn with our experiences, to respond better than we did.
Yeah, the thing on the line here is sixth place potentially for Champions League football and the Premier League at this stage. If Aston Villa managed to go on and win this whole thing, there'll be another six teams in the Champions League next season from the Premier League. Most likely Brighton, you'd have to say at this point.
Is that the way to look at a European competition semi-final? Like, is that
the way I look at it?
I know it is. I know. I'm just questioning you, and I'm just, wondering if that's what
it's pretty awful, isn't it? The Champions League, and then we're talking about six coming from one league. It's making a nonsense of it, isn't it?
And there's a possibility of there being 10 English clubs in Europe, full stop, next season, with a couple of other far more complicated permutations at the end of the season.
Well, the Champions League didn't, with Arsenal's accepted, it hasn't really worked. Having so many last season didn't work out so well for them, and actually kind of exposed the real weaknesses in the English game. So, and obviously it also creates that ongoing imbalance in terms of finance, that the money is all going into English clubs, which isn't good for European football. European football doesn't really care. But I think I would like to see Villa do well in this and win the Europa League.
The Premiership's strength is also its weakness, isn't it? I mean, you get five Premiership clubs in the knockout stages of the Champions League. Liga, Bundesliga, Serie A, any other league in Europe couldn't even begin to dream of such an achievement. But it also means it makes the Premiership much more of a slog, more difficult to win, and it's also more draining. By comparison, PSG and Bayern are pretty much guaranteed to win Ligue 1 and the Bundesliga every time the season kicks off, which means that they come towards the business end of the season, they're much fresher, they haven't had to dig as deep to win their league, and of course they've also got massive budgets as well and huge wage bills, so they can afford all these wonderful players, and then they treat us to an attacking feast like they did on Tuesday night, because mostly because the two of them never really have to defend much domestically, probably.
So it's Forest Villa at 8 o'clock and Braga Freiburg in the other semi at 8 o'clock as well. Then, David, we have Conference League action tonight also with some Premier League interest.
Yes, Crystal Palace face Ukrainian outfit Shakhtar Donetsk in Poland this evening. Oli Glasner's side have had a return to form in recent weeks after a turbulent mid-season. They'll be looking to repeat last season's success with their FA Cup win, their first ever major trophy. Glasner is, of course, leaving the club at the end of this season, but he insists that's not on their mind heading into the final few games.
Thank you.
No, just focused on tomorrow, and the message is always the same. So we don't talk about the result, so I expect that the decision will be taken at Selhurst, not in the first leg. And the message is always, be yourself, play our style, play our football, express yourself, play with confidence, try to score goals. Of course, defend as a team, work very hard to avoid chances for the opposition. But the most important thing is play our style. So why we are here where we are is because we created our personality.
Meanwhile, Manchester United midfielder Kobbie Mainoo has penned a new deal at the club, which will keep him there until 2031. He's made 98 appearances, scoring 7 goals since his debut 3 years ago. He'd fallen out of favour under previous manager Ruben Amorim, which had thrown his future at the Red Devils into question. However, since the appointment of Michael Carrick earlier this year, he's been a mainstay in the Manchester midfield and has now been rewarded for his uptick in form. And now he says he wants to help his boyhood club fight for major trophies.
Headline writer's dream today in terms of what's happening at Burnley.
Yeah, Burnley are on the hunt for a new manager following the departure of Scott Parker. The former Fulham boss left the Clarets by mutual consent following their relegation from the Premier League. They won just four league games under the former Fulham boss this season. Mike Jackson will take charge on an interim basis for the remainder of the campaign. The BBC is also reporting that the club have highlighted Wales manager Craig Bellamy as a potential replacement. He, of course, has some ties to the club, having previously been on the coaching ticket under Vincent Kompany.
You really didn't do my tee up much good there, David, by calling him Mike Jackson instead of Michael Jackson. It's like one of the most sort of lowbrow things that I get massive joy out of, just seeing like a Michael Jackson in the wild or like a Harry Potter for the Australian rugby team last year. Just nothing brings me greater joy than that. I don't know why.
I didn't even put two and two together. I'm sorry. I completely flew over my head.
We also have managerial news elsewhere. West Brom.
Yes, West Brom have confirmed the appointment of James Morrison on a two-year deal. He took over on an interim basis and guided the Baggies to safety in the Championship. He took over from Eric Ramsey, who was sacked back in February after just 9 games at the helm. And since Morrison has joined, they've lost just 1 out of his 14 games in charge.
Big retirement news then.
Yes, Ashley Young has confirmed his retirement from football at the age of 40. He's played 765 professional games in a career spanning over 2 decades. He played for Watford, Aston Villa, Manchester United, Everton, Inter Milan and Ipswich across his time in the game. And he also won 39 caps for England.
Something we'll come back to on the football show is the Owen Elding story. What's going on here?
So former Sligo Rovers player Owen Elding has been linked with a call-up to the England underage setup following his move to Hibs earlier this year. He made the move to the Scottish Premiership in January and has hit the ground running since his arrival. He's scored 3 goals in 9 matches since joining the Edinburgh outfit. He's long been touted with an inclusion in the Ireland under-21 squad. However, issues with receiving his passport have delayed that call-up. The Irish Sun is now reporting that the English FA have noticed his good form and are now interested in bringing him into their own camp.
Finally then, we have a rugby story and we have the latest on the snooker.
Yes, the Irish Independent is reporting that Roger Randall's move to Munster is set to be cancelled. The appointment has been shrouded in controversy following its announcement earlier this month. He was previously accused of rape while he played for the Hurricanes in 1997 and he has always denied the allegations. However, the move was met with some backlash both inside and outside of the club. Former players Billy Holland, Killian Keane and Mick O'Driscoll have resigned from their roles on the Professional Games Committee and it's now understood that the move will be scrapped following on from the reaction to the appointment. And in the World Snooker Championships, it's finished all square in the first session of this year's semi-finals. The frames are shared 4 apiece between Sean Murphy and John Higgins. They'll resume tomorrow morning. All eyes now turn to the evening session where Mark Allen faces Wu Yeatsa in the final 4. It's Allen's 3rd time reaching this stage of the competition and he's bidding to become the oldest first-time winner of the tournament. While his opponent, aged just 22, has never reached the semi-finals until now. He does, however, have an international championship to his name and has previously made the semis at the Masters and that game has just gotten underway in the last few minutes.
Surely I'm in the company of 2 snooker fans here.
Yeah, I haven't seen any snooker this year. I don't mean like all through the year, because obviously I wouldn't have, but I mean during the World Championships. And normally I would have seen some, so I actually, Dave has given the news there. I was like, okay, I've got to get some in now before the...
Lock in now, yeah.
Lock in now.
I'd tune into the World Championships, but very little else, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I'd be more a Ronnie O'Sullivan fan, and he's already gone, so like... I'd be more a Ronnie O'Sullivan fan than a snooker fan, if you know what I mean. I would always watch him.
Seamus has been in touch on YouTube to say, will Newcastle be the next to get their funding pulled? Dion last week said it'll be the next big story in football. We might come back to that actually on the football show after 9 o'clock. And a couple of more texts on Liv. John says, Liv Golf and other Saudi sporting ventures were all about projecting global influence generally for the country. It went hand in hand with building a futuristic metropolis and other grand projects which collapsed under the weight of vaunting ambition built on foundations of sand. And Kev says those ex-golfers now face a large hole they dug themselves. And no doubt the others won't let them live to forget it either. I see what you did there, Kev. You're getting the headline writer's memo here, Kev. Thank you very much for coming to us with your puns. Our number is 087-9180-180. And you can get us on WhatsApp. David, thank you very much for tonight's News Round. Dion, we'll chat to you after 9 o'clock tonight. Jerry, you're going to stick with us for a special Thursday Night Rugby after the break. Just to let you know, the News Round is brought to you by Viagra Connect 50mg film-coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150mg tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.